Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 40 and is a continuation of episode 39, part 2 of the story of the Babushka Lady. In today's episode, we finish up the rest of Beverly Oliver's story in her own words, and then I'll have the final word on this far-out and fantastic set of two episodes. Or will I? Well, with Beverly Oliver present, you never know who is going to get the last words in. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 40.
There's just so much to tell, I always leave out something. Saturday night, before the assassination, on the 21st, I was with Jack Ruby at the Cabana, but what's the name of the club? Anyway, the big supper club there. Yeah, the Bon Vivant. Yeah, and then we were there for dancing and drinks, and there were several people there with us. One man's name was Lawrence Meyer, and for some reason, Jack Ruby called him Mr. Meyer all night long. There's another guy that I was introduced to as Jack Lawrence, and we stayed for a little while. I was dancing with Jack Lawrence most of the time, so I don't know what the conversation was, but we get back to the table, and Jack says, Mr. Lawrence wants steak, so we're going to go out to the Egyptian Lounge, Campisi's Egyptian Lounge, because they did have the best steaks in Dallas back then. They still have pretty good steaks. And so we all went out there, and at one point in time, they got up and went to the office to call, make a phone call. They said there's a calling somebody. Came back in, a few more gracious things were said, and we left, and we went back to the hotel. And it was close to midnight, so I went into the bathroom at the Cabana Hotel, changed my clothes to go to a party in Fort Worth that night. No, it was not at the Cellar. It was another party. It was a private party. And that's what I was doing in Fort Worth. And the next morning, I rode the cab back to Dallas and picked up my stuff and went down to Dooley Plaza. Now, the man who took my film, his name was Regis Kennedy. He was an FBI agent. He was sent to Dallas on the 25th, the morning of the 25th, to be one of the field agents in Dallas investigating the assassination of President Kennedy. Regis Kennedy was also the FBI agent that they sent to New Orleans to investigate Carlos Marcellus, who went back to the government and told him, oh, he's just another tomato salesman. But I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald is exactly what he said he was. He was a patsy. And I do believe with all my heart that Jack Ruby shot him to shut him up.
Can you tell him about the trip that you took with Ruby to New Orleans?
Yes, that was, I'm going to say, probably June or July. I don't remember exactly when, before the assassination. Jack asked me to go to New Orleans with him to the show bar. You'll remember where that is. And he was going to look for some new showgirls, and that's how Jada got down here. He hired Jada that week. And he was looking for an assistant manager in his club. And so wouldn't you expect, if you heard him say this, that he went to New Orleans to hire showgirls and to find an assistant manager for his club? And then about September, this weird-looking guy. I mean, there's no way, unless you see a picture of David Ferry, could anybody ever explain to you what he looked like. But if you saw the JFK movie, Joe Pesci didn't do a good job on the way he looked. Let me tell you, this guy was freaky looking. He had alopecia, so his hair was falling out, not just like here. It was just in chunks over his head. So his hair was all spiky, and back then spike cuts weren't style. And he had no eyebrows, so he took a coal pencil and drew his eyebrows in a half moon over his face, and he had a little beaky nose. I always said, when they asked me to describe him, I said he looked like a buzzard. And that's what he did. Well, this man starts showing up about September, and he would stand at the door. He would greet people. How many of you were from Dallas back then, but Dallas in 1963 was BYOB, which means bring your own bottle. We didn't have liquor by the drink until 2 or 3 years later. And we didn't have microwaves back then, but all the bars had little bar pizzas and those little ovens, little cabinet ovens that you stuck them in, broiled them, took them out, took them to the customers. He'd help himself to the pizzas. He would help himself to Jack's private selection. Now, Jack didn't drink, but he kept stuff there like scotch, mostly scotch. That's why I hated the Kennedy so bad, because I got a portion of his scotch. And this guy would go help himself to the liquor behind the bar like he owned the place. So did I have a right to believe he was an assistant manager? I thought he was.
One last thing I want you to tell him is the when you mentioned that Jack hated the Kennedys, but the press has said he loved the Kennedys. That's why he killed Ruby.
He loved Jacqueline. He thought she was a lady of class. But that story about him killing Oswald so that she would not have to come back for a trial, that was a bunch of hogwash. He absolutely said, I hate John Kennedy. I hate his so-and-so Bobby. And he said, and I hate, no, I cannot say the words, he said, their daddy even more than them put together. He didn't say anything about Ted. But those three, he hated with a passion. And I joke about it because, you know, even to this day, the Kennedy family gets a portion of every bottle of scotch you buy. They brought scotch to the United States, and they still get a percentage of every bottle of scotch that's sold in the USA.
I won't tell you all about my background, but I did go to school in Rochester, New York, and in the process, spent a lot of time with Kodak scientists and would-be scientists. And what you say about the film, that it could have been experimental.
It was.
And I believe that wholeheartedly, and that gives credibility to what you're saying, that the camera and the film was given you in instructions that it had to be processed by Kodak for it to possibly even exist. My question is that when the film was taken from you along with the camera...
The camera wasn't taken.
The camera wasn't, but the
film
was.
It was stolen in 1977.
Did the FBI agent know that that was experimental film? Because this is true. Kodak would send film out all the time to people and cameras to try new film, but new chemicals that would process that film. And if you took it down the corner drugstore, it could destroy the film very easily. Did they know that this was experimental film?
I didn't tell them that, but it was very obvious that they had never seen it before because it was the first magazine-loaded camera, the square plastic magazine. You did have to still turn it over, but it was in a plastic square magazine. So I'm sure that they knew, and it said on there, you know how it says Kodak and Rochester, New York, and the address on all of their film did back then. And so I'm sure that's where they sent it.
It could have been a cover-up, too. They could have messed up and tried to process it themselves and destroyed the film.
Oh, I doubt that.
You doubt it?
I doubt that.
You think this gentleman is credible?
I do.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
I don't know if you noticed or not, but the portion that I thought was my film and still think it was my film, which Robert Groden, a dear friend of mine who was on the Geraldo show, doesn't think it was my film. But like I said, Nix was standing up at the corner of Maine and Houston. I was down at the pergola. That picture was not taken. That film was not taken from up there at Main Street, and there was no way he could have taken the film that he did take that you saw, which was also black and white, make it all the way down there by the time the headshot was done. Couldn't do it. Physically impossible.
I would like to know, of all the people that were out there, and you were out there, how did the FBI know who you were and that you took these pictures? And they knew how to find you, because you said it wasn't very long.
It was Monday night, and it's because Roscoe White, who was a Dallas policeman, whose wife worked for Jack Ruby, he knew me. I made eye contact with him, and I knew that he recognized me, and I knew that he would know where to find me if they wanted to question me. I wanted to go find out what had happened to my president. The thing I didn't think through was that the first of the month of November, I gave up my apartment, and I was renting another apartment called Beachview Apartments in Dallas, and my apartment wasn't going to be ready until the 1st of December. So for that month of November the 1st to December the 1st, I had moved out in Garland, Texas with my mom and daddy, and my boss didn't even know where I was staying. So they had to wait till I came to work. and I didn't go to work till Monday night. Now, I want to straighten up about my camera being stolen. My camera, they just took the film out, gave me my camera back. But I gave testimony to the House Select Committee in March of 1977, and I'm not saying this had anything to do with it. But my husband and I are in the ministry now. He's celebrating his 59th year of ordination May of next year. Or is it 60? 60 years next year. And we were on the road all the time in revivals like we still do. We drive on a big bus. And we were at his mom and dad's house. I had put a suitcase out in the storage building with a lot of our other stuff. We didn't even have a home for a long time. We call them our Porter Parsonages. We had buses. We do have a home now. But you remember those round suitcases? I put all my old pictures, that camera, and everything in that round suitcase. We got back home in May, and somebody had broken into that suitcase. We came back home because our little boy died on the road. And I went out there to get that suitcase, and it was gone. And the strange thing is, out of everything, that whole set of Samsonite luggage was there. That was the only one missing. So whether that had anything to do with it, I don't know.
Yes, ma'am. I sure appreciate hearing everything you've had.
Thank you.
Really interested. But one of the critical things I've always wondered about, and since you were there as an eyewitness, could you tell us to the best of your ability exactly how many shots you heard?
You know, I couldn't for a long time because I was in such shock. And I did wipe a lot of things. And there's a lot of things that have come back to my memory over the years that I will not share. Because every time I have finished something like a thought and it finally comes together and I ever told anybody, I was accused of changing my story. So what I know is staying with me. But I went under hypnosis. Koch was the witness with the president of the Texas Board of Hypnotists here in Dallas. And did we have two sessions, Koch? Was it two sessions? Two, and they were recorded because I wasn't taking any chances. I didn't believe in hypnosis, you know, but I was willing to do anything. And under hypnosis, I heard five shots that went bang, 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 ba-boom. And a little while later, after we did that, he gave me a copy of the tape. And that is the spookiest thing in the world because when you're hypnotized, it's not I did such and such and I went so and so. It's I'm walking down the street. I'm walking up Commerce. I put the camera in my, you know, it's that day. And at one point, I became so hysterical that he had to pull me up above the crowd and look down on the situation. And what they were really trying to do is see if I, in my peripheral memory, if there was something there that wasn't in my conscious mind.
That if you're looking at that, we've seen this stuff for 49 years. My question is, one, why haven't we seen that before? And then if you summarize it, you can just look at it and say, there's your answer. But mm-hmm. Why haven't we seen that photograph on anything, any books, any history channels, or anything?
The only answer that I have is the man Timo Makonen from Finland was told by Seth Cantor, I finally remembered his name, who's an author that's written some books on the assassination of President Kennedy. He was found down in the ATI building in New York looking at the film, and he was run out. And so he was the one who told Timo Makonen where the film was, what safe it was in, what canister it's in. Supposedly it's in a big film canister with six copies of my film in there. And he told him to go in under the auspices of doing a documentary on how to restore and keep old film footage. And he told him, he said, when you get it out, put it on the roller, which is the thing that they roll it forward to. You get to the headshot and then get as many stills as you can, because when they catch you, they're going to kick you out. And so he was able to get those four stills. He came to Ranger, Texas, and scared the mud out of me, and brought that stuff to me. One of the reasons when I talk about being scared, shortly after I was on Geraldo's show and told him I was writing a book, this came in the mail to me. Can you see that? It says death in big black letters. Then a week later, this comes, snitch, you're dead. Both of them mailed from Houston, Texas. At that time, I knew no one in Houston, Texas. I took them to the federal marshal in Lubbock, Texas, and, of course, they couldn't get anything off them because too many people had handled it. But this is still a very touchy subject.
Just over a week ago, I heard Jim Lavelle, who was handcuffed to Oswald, say that for months and weeks he investigated, and he saw no connection whatsoever that Oswald and Ruby knew each other. What is your take on that? I've heard your testimony. Give me
your opinion. Well, Jim and I are very good friends, and I, for a long time, I took him to lunch once a month. I haven't, for the last several months, ever since he had his accident, lost his eye. I haven't been able to do it because my schedule has been so busy. But we talk, and he's a very dear friend of mine, and we get along just fine because it's just like I told him. I said, all you know is what you investigated after the fact and what they told you from upstairs. What I know, I saw with my own eyes. Now, how many of you have ever heard the name Jack Revel? Jack Revel was the head of intelligence in Dallas at the time of the President's Kennedy. My cousin. He just died 3 months ago. So I have very close connections with those people. And that's the only thing I can say is that he just knows what he saw after the fact, and he was probably, like the Warren Commission, issued some things that he was supposed to come up with. And because I love Jim, and I don't think he would intentionally lie. I just don't believe that he would, because he's a very honorable man. But, you know, and some people say, well, you can't count on eyewitness testimony. That's what they always say, Ken. All I know is that every big murder case there is, they say, well, we don't have an eyewitness. So I just know what I saw, and I still don't believe that Jim Lavelle would tell a lie intentionally. And I think he really believes what he believes. Now, my cousin, when we were estranged for a long time, and at his sister's funeral, we got back together. His sister, Hallie D, and I got Hallie D died, and at her funeral, we made amends. And he wanted one of my books. And I said, well, Jack, you know that we're not going to agree on this assassination. And his words to me is, you don't know what I believe, and you might be surprised.
My question was, how many times did you see Lee Harvey Oswald in the club? Just the one, or?
No. Mm-mm. No, I saw him. That was the first night that I actually was introduced to him. Then I saw him a couple of times at after-hours parties, and then I was there the night, which I wish I had. I might have to get a copy of that from her. Geraldo Rivera also interviewed Wally Weston. His Shoemaker was his real last name, and he was the MC at the Carousel Club. And one night, I walked in to the last show, and the stand-up comedian, Wally Weston, was doing his stand-up comedian part. And this Lee Harvey Oswald in the back of the room stood up, and he said, I think you're an effing communist, which back in the 60s, that's the worst thing you could call somebody here in America was a communist. And Wally said, what did you say? He said, I think you're an effing communist, except he said the word. And Wally just put his mic down and put his hand down on the floor and hopped off there and went back there, and he was an amateur boxer. And he drew back and cold-cocked him right in the face. And then Jack Ruby came over there and shook him, and he pushed him down the stairs, and he said, I told you, you little SOB, don't you come back in this club anymore. Of course, he was back again, but that was an incident that was actually brought out on national television when Wally gave his testimony, and I happened to be in there that night at the Carousel. How did you? I sang my first song in public when I was 3 years old at the First Assembly of God Church in Garland, Texas. Now, back then, Assembly of God people didn't believe in wearing makeup and watching TV. You couldn't have a TV. They're not like that anymore. And but my babysitter had a TV, and we were very poor growing up. I mean, I didn't have an inside bathroom until I was 12 years old. And there was these beautiful ladies that would sit on the piano with feathers in their hair and these pretty clothes on singing, and they were called saloon singers. Well, one Sunday morning after I got through singing in church, Brother Woods picked me up like this, and he said, and Beverly, what do you want to be when you get grown? I said, a saloon singer. You can hear those people suck air for days. So when I grew up, I was actually 9 years old when I started singing on country western stage shows around Dallas. Y'all remember the Big D Jamboree and the Cowtown Hoedown and those shows? I sang on those starting at the age of 9. And by the time I was 13 years old, I started singing in nightclubs on the weekends. And my mom and dad signed me over to Abe Weinstein when I was 14 years old. Actually 16 years old when they signed the contracts over, because I was so determined to be an entertainer that my daddy felt like, you know, they'd rather know what I was doing, because I'd been sneaking out of the house and riding a bus from Garland, Texas. Y'all remember where the old bus station was? All the way to downtown Dallas, and they thought I was staying with my good friends, Mary Noelle Peterson. And back then, we didn't have phones, so they didn't have any way to check on me. So when they found out what I was doing, they figured out it was better to know what I was doing. So they basically signed me over to Abe Weinstein.
On the, on your first of your presentation, you had four quick snapshots about the second slide that you showed when you were younger.
Yeah.
And you ran over them pretty quickly.
Oh, and, no, you're not going to see that one.
Yeah, well, you ran over one of them pretty quickly. I heard Dixie Mafia in there. Yes. Could you elaborate a little on that?
Oh, yeah. In 1966, I married a man named George Albert McGann. And George Albert McGann, according to Lieutenant... Captain McCarran of the Dallas Police Station, was the leader of the Dixie Mafia. And the Dixie Mafia was also what they call crossroaders. That was the first beginning of the mafia that was not really Costa Nostra. They weren't Italian.
But thugs.
They, huh?
Thugs.
Thugs. We married 4.5 years, and he was assassinated, shot in the back 4 times in the abdomen once in a gangland slaying in Lubbock, Texas.
So why do you think Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald, and how was he able to get all the way down in that garage up to the guy like that without the police being involved?
Well,
maybe I shouldn't have said that.
You just kind of answered your own question.
Right.
He shot him to shut him up. I don't know. Don't know if it's the government, if it was mob. That's the whole thing about this.
I can answer that question. All the policemen were customers at Ruby's Lounge. Mm-hmm.
But they were also customers at the Carousel Club, at the Colony Club, and at the Theater Lounge. I mean, they made they let them in free to watch the strip shows, and they had coffee cups. I don't know if it's coffee in there or not. Oh, I've got to answer this question, too. I'm disappointed nobody asked it. Usually the first question when I speak to kids is, were you a stripper? I tell them, well, I'm going to be honest with you. I tried it once. And the men in the crowd started yelling, put it back on! So I knew I better stick to singing.
Ruby used to give the policemen cards, free drinks and free entrance.
But their drinks were always in a coffee cup. Always.
Always.
I want to ask you something later, but one thing I had heard right here.
Where?
One thing I had heard was that people were saying that Jack Ruby had his dog with him when he went up there, and a lot of people have said that he didn't really plan, that that was just something that he, but because they said he wouldn't have had his dog and left his dog in the truck. And
he took his dog with him and left the dog in the car because then he knew somebody would find Sheba and take care of her. Now, the little dancer, little Lynn, that he supposedly was downtown wiring money to, that y'all have all heard for years and years and years, she was dead. She died 2 years ago now. Her son, Michael, called me. We found her about in 1990, and then this weird guy found her, too, and pushed her back underground. But that was all a setup deal. That was planned long ahead that he would go downtown and wire money to Lynn. Her name is Carlin's, her last name.
I'm going to ask the last question. What is your thinking of when Johnny Roselli was found cut up in a barrel, and then also the guy who was supposed to testify before the Senate committee the next day and had an airplane ticket to go to Washington, and he was gunned down in his apartment?
Well, that's just part of the assassination. You know, like, for instance, Roscoe White, who I picked out of a mug book as the person who took my film, really was an FBI agent named Roscoe White, named Regis Kennedy. And 6 weeks before he was to go before the House, or the House Select Committee on Assassinations and give testimony about my film, that's what he was being called before the committee for, he died.
And by the way, Dorothy Kilgallen, bless her heart, she was murdered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she was.
Beverly Oliver, Coke Buchanan, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, and let's keep the torch burning. Don't ever let the flame die.
Whether Beverly Oliver is Babushka Lady is one thing. Actually, one very important thing. And she may very well be the Babushka Lady. Some credible researchers acknowledge the fantastic nature of her claims, but have decided to accept her story anyway of being in Dealey Plaza that day. That group includes Jim Marr, who wrote Crossfire, one of the early and leading books on the assassination and conspiracy. Arguably, Mr. Marr is a hardcore conspiracy theorist, so he is more forgiving on some of the doubtful details that surround Beverly. But nevertheless, she gets a nod from Mr. Marr. One thing is for sure, this is one hell of a story and really fun to listen to. It's just hard to sort out all that's been said by Beverly Oliver and about Beverly Oliver and figure out what it all means to the JFK assassination story. In March 1979, and this was after Beverly had come forth and was now the publicly identified face of Babushka Lady, the Photographic Evidence Panel of the United States House Select Committee on Assassinations, a group you are now familiar with based on previous episodes, indicated that they were unable to locate any film attributed to the Babushka Lady. According to their report, which Robert Groden had a big hand in putting together, he was the famous photo consultant to the committee that had previously worked on the Zapruder film. Well, Groden advised the panel as to pertinent photographic issues and related materials. Committee investigators located many of the suggested films and photographs. However, some items were never located. The most prominent of these known and missing materials included the Babushka Lady film, a color photograph by Norman Simelis, and the original negative of the Betzner photograph. Now, we all know that if a government agency had confiscated it and wanted to destroy that evidence, it would have been gone within a nanosecond after the assassination. So the chances of it being available for retrieval, even by a sanctioned investigation carried on by an instrument of Congress, one that has occurred 15 years after the assassination, well, those chances were probably nil. I am not saying that is what happened, because if it did happen, it would have been outrageous. From everything we know about the assassination, it was possible during those times, but not likely in this case to be probable. What adds to the skepticism about her story on this point is that she, at one point, identified Regis Kennedy, a local Dallas FBI agent that was heavily involved in investigating the Kennedy assassination. Well, she identified him as the agent that was there that night at the Colony Club to meet her as she arrived for work and was one of the two agents who confiscated her film. That was Monday night, November 25th, 1963. Other researchers contend that Regis Kennedy was in New Orleans the night of the 25th, interviewing Dean Andrews. You might know him. He's the shuck and jive attorney that had a moment of fame in the Clay Shaw trial. And he figures into things later in this story. By the way, I can't wait to do that character. My crappy Texas accent is better at portraying a shuck and jive Cajun attorney. Or so I think. You'll get to suffer through it soon enough and make the call on that one yourself. The House Select inquiries to the FBI about the existence of the film, inquiries made in 1979, were probably just no more than going through the motions. And it's not surprising that whatever inquiries they made at the time to the FBI about the whereabouts of that film, well, that the answer back from the FBI would be something like, "We don't know. We don't even know what she is talking about." Right? That's probably what they said. Well, I'm just saying. You know, the House Select Committee did a lot of that, by the way, sort of check-the-box stuff. They even went down and sat with Fidel Castro. They did that in a face-to-face interview. Blakey did this. And they actually sat there and asked Castro if he did it. Can you imagine that conversation? It was probably all Castro could do to hold in the chuckle. Really? Ask Castro if he killed Kennedy? I'm sure there was zero chance that he would have said yes, even if he had done it. Well, I guess as a tidy investigator, you have to ask for the record. All right. Well, enough of that, Wander. Gary Mack is a relatively well-respected JFK assassination researcher. Mr. Mack has since passed, and some of the crusade for truth among legitimate research passed with him. He did have his edgy side when it came to the JFK assassination story, and we'll get a chance to hear that in the next episode when we hear about Badge Man, which is another mysterious figure on the grassy knoll that day. Gary Mack played a central role in researching and promoting Badge Man, and he gave birth to the related conspiracy theories that spawned from it. On November 18, 1994, Mr. Mack testified before the Assassination Records Review Board. He stated that, at that time, he had recently been told by an executive in Kodak's Dallas office that a woman in her early 30s with brunette hair brought in film purported to be of the assassination scene while they were processing the Zapruder film. According to Mack, the executive said that the woman explained to federal investigators already at the film processing office that she ran from the main street across the grass to Elm Street, where she stopped and snapped a photo with some people in the foreground of the presidential limousine and the Texas School Book Depository. Mack said that he was told by the Kodak executive that the photo was extremely blurry and virtually useless, and indicated that the woman likely went home without anyone recording her identity. It should be noted that this story involved a still photo, which makes this statement to the records board somewhat quizzical to me, as the babushka lady appeared to be operating a movie camera in the plaza. But, nevertheless, that is not definitive, and the rest of the facts fit the babushka description. After suggesting that the woman in the story may have been the babushka lady, Mack then told the board, "I do not believe that Beverly Oliver is the babushka lady." Or, let me rephrase that. She certainly could be, but the rest of the story is a fabrication. In fairness to Beverly, Mack was a meticulous researcher, and there were some elements of her story that impressed him and certainly gave credence to the idea that Beverly Oliver was the babushka lady. He took her to Dealey Plaza, and she picked out the exact place that the babushka lady was standing, as seen in the Zapruder film. There really hadn't been much in the way of photographic evidence available yet at the time for her to be clued in to what that evidence indicated, and the Zapruder film was not yet available publicly at that time as well. Also appearing that same day before the ARRB as Beverly Oliver Masegi, now married and no longer going by her maiden name, went on to tell the Records Review Board pretty much the same story you heard directly from her in these episodes about the confiscation of the film and the theft of the camera. You've already heard her more detailed story on all that in her own words. You know, I like this lady, even though I am pretty certain there is at least some hyperbole in the middle of all of this. And, well, maybe more. But it's just not provable either way. And at times, her pedigree, her background, her involvement at the Colony Club, and her connection with that crowd that hung out with Ruby and others, her legitimate connection with all of that, what she really did see and participate in, well, some of it is definitely true, no doubt about it. And her conviction of delivery makes you want to believe more. But your adult self cautions against it. The trouble is, again, what part of her story is the something else? She was closer to the mob action than most people think. It's worth reiterating one more point on that if you missed it during her discussion. In 1966, when she was about 20 years of age, she married George McGann. McGann was murdered in 1970 under suspicious circumstances that some went so far as to characterize as a gangland-style murder. He was likely a mobster, perhaps even a hitman of sorts, based on his background. He and Beverly ran the Sky King nightclub together in the short time they were married. Oliver maintained that McGann was opposed to her talking about the assassination, and Oliver claimed that at one point he even threatened to kill her if she spoke about it. How credible this claim is, well, you have to believe in her to believe it. But circumstantially, given who he was, it seems plausible. She didn't wait too long after this to remarry. She began to attend church revivals as she pivoted to becoming a fundamentalist Christian, and eventually married a Baptist preacher named Charles Massagi, to whom she was still married when she gave her 2013 interview. A little bit about her personal history that wasn't told by her in her interview. She gave birth to 4 children. A daughter at the age of 17 that was given up for adoption. A son with McGann, the mobster type. A baby that died within hours of his birth. Then a third child, a son with Massagi, who passed within 3 months. And then finally, her 4th and youngest child, her daughter, Pebbles, who suffers from a genetic disorder. Oliver donated one of her kidneys to save Pebbles' life. There is a sadness about all of this, but giving her kidney to her daughter tells a lot about who she really is. I think it reveals a lot. Some people who have looked at images of the babushka lady and pictures of Oliver as a young woman, and as slender as she was in those days, have said that the babushka lady looked too old and weighed too much to be Oliver. Oliver vehemently denies that. Not sure what there is to deny there, but she says it's her. One of the books that she wrote after she appeared in The Men Who Killed Kennedy was co-authored by Coke Buchanan. It was called Nightmare in Dallas, and it was published in 1994. This was but one more of the things that contributed to her continuing notoriety around the time of her statements made to the Assassination Records Review Board. It also contained many facts that serious researchers like to impugn. And the controversy continued over time. At a press conference in 1999, you heard a little bit about that in her own words. Oliver claimed that 4 frames of her film had been located. She showed one to Doug Horn, an assassination researcher, stating that it must be hers because she wasn't in the shot. Horn said that he believed the film to have been taken from farther west than the babushka lady was seen in other films. She also showed the other 3 images to John Hunt Jr., who was also a JFK assassination researcher, and he recognized them to be stills from the next film. Sorry, Beverly. I have to call this one out. I'm just saying. Over the years, she has been called out on many other specific facts as well. Probably the most notable relates to her reference to the use of a Yashica Super 8 Zoom movie camera at the scene in Dealey Plaza on the day of the assassination. Apparently, she maintained that this camera was given to her by her then-boyfriend Larry Ronco. You heard her say that right in her interview. She had met Ronco while working a second job at the Six Flags Over Texas amusement park. Based on Beverly's account, Ronco, who worked for the Eastman Kodak Company, had been hired to film and photograph the Six Flags amusement park for use in advertising, and based on Beverly's account, apparently managed the Kodak presentation at the park as well. When the park found out that Beverly was also working at the Colony Club, well, my understanding is that they fired her. Not fair, but that is how it was back then. Or anyway, so she tells the story that way. It gets more juicy. Ronco apparently proposed to her, despite the fact that he himself was married at the time. Later, after she fled Dallas, after the assassination, she purportedly would file a restraining order against him. Lots of drama here. The Yashica Super 8 camera was not manufactured until 1965. It was not in existence in 1963 at the time of the assassination. Despite maintaining the story in many venues, including her interview that appeared on The Men Who Killed Kennedy, she would later revise it and even denied she had ever said that when she made her statements to the Assassination Records Review Board in 1994. I know, it's just a make and model of the camera. She was 17, and she was not an amateur photographer. What did she know about cameras at that point in life? But it's strange that she would have been so specific about the type of camera and then have this fact-check speed bump appear squarely in the road ahead of her. Now, in fairness to Beverly, you just heard a person that was in the audience address this very issue. A person from the audience who asked a question and made a statement about the camera and the film. A person who actually worked for Kodak in Rochester back in the day. And he validated that it very well might have been an experimental camera, as she has been saying in more recent years. Not sure what his expertise in the area really was, but he sure sounded like he knew what he was talking about. Well, maybe the story might really have legitimacy. So there, far out and fantastic, yes, and maybe even true. Well, the substantive part of it, anyway, that there was a camera and it was experimental. I don't want to be too hard on Beverly Oliver, but as a juror, you have to know all the facts. The reason I like Beverly Oliver is that no matter how much she has contributed to turning the JFK research into an edgy proposition at times, I honestly think she really cares about the country. She cares about the truth. There is no doubt she has used this circumstance as an instrument of some personal advancement. It's not hard to figure that out. Maybe about 30 seconds in, you can figure that out. Probably more for personal notoriety than anything else. Even though she claims she never wanted to be in the spotlight regarding the JFK assassination. And that may very well have been true at first. But let's face it, she was a showgirl, and once a showgirl hits the stage, well, you just have to perform. She's written a few books, like so many people and some of the other celebrity witnesses have. I'm sure she's signed her share of autographs too, etc., etc. So probably there was some economic aggrandizement in it. However, nobody got rich on that score. No matter what, she is part of the vociferous voice that has kept the country on the hunt, marching forward from the 60s for the last 50 years in a way that has helped to keep the spotlight on the topic of solving the case. As far as Beverly goes, there is no doubt her story is far out and fantastic. Choose to believe all of it, or only parts of it. Either way, in her own way, I think Beverly Oliver is a bit of a patriot. And that is my story, and I'm sticking to it.
The truth shall set us free. I want to close my presentation tonight, and I'll take questions and answer questions in just a minute. But each year, almost every year, sometimes I miss like I'm missing this year, I am honored to sing at Dealey Plaza for the memorial service of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And they have a little program down there, and I start the program off by singing the Star-Spangled Banner and a couple of patriotic songs. But at 12:30, when the president was shot, no matter who's speaking, I step up to the microphone, and I sing what was supposed to be, and I believe it was, President Kennedy's favorite song. And I want to share that with you tonight, just like I do at Dealey Plaza. And I'm going to do it a cappella, like I do most of the time. And if you've ever seen the men Who Killed Kennedy, then you know what I'm going to sing.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. His grace hath brought me safe thus far. His grace will lead me on when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun. We've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. Amazing grace.
Thank you for listening to episode 40 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.